I'm Tim Hopkins, and this is Freaky Trigger and the Lollards of Pop. It's just gone midday on Sunday the 28th of January, and it's the beginning of Resonance FM 104.4's broadcast day. I'm delighted to say we're broadcasting live from Bagwell's Fish Stall, just off the Sidmouth Beach in East Devon. It's a little delightful area of Sidmouth called the Ham, funnily enough. We were going to be on Branscombe Beach to see what we could pick up, but the police have it all closed off. Oh well, no matter. What's ahead? Well, in your radio box I have such delights. We'll be using our amateur structuralist chops to hack merrily away at magic. That's magic with a K, or without a K, you can decide for yourself. That's the joy of radio. You're going to like this bit. Not a lot, but you'll like it. There'll be some talk about artificial language, which is to say made-up language, not just a load of old nonsense. Actually, I might reserve judgment on that for now. Consultation time has been booked with two of our favourite doctors. We hope your favourite doctors as well. And we'll be harking back to the halcyon days when we could all watch dodgy travel programmes on the telly without worrying about leaving mucky carbon footprints all over the surface of the earth. There'll be music from Talk Talk, DJ Wonder and Can. Plus, we'll be using our privileged place in the week to be the first to announce the all-new UK number one. Your Lollards today are Mark Sinker, Cat Stevens, and first-time Lollard, Alex Campbell. Say hello, Alex.
Hello, Alex.
How to resist? Don't. Return to your luncheon and prepare for befuddlement. First, though, what's gone before? Nonsense, when all is said and done, is still nonsense. But the study of nonsense, now that is science. Freaky Trigger, the internet's only marginally sane collective, drops science so you can pick it back up again. It's been a quiet week on the Trigger. Everyone's been busying themselves with babies or boozes, and our film reviewing machine, Pete Barron, is on a fact-finding trip to New York. Can it really be true that he'll have to tip a dollar a drink? Surely not. What's more, most of the team have been suffering from a demon case of writer's block, brought about by the fact that they can't stop their hands shaking with excitement at the prospect of our next Poptimism night out. It's next Friday, which is to say the 2nd of February, and it takes place at the Union Tavern on King's Cross Road. And it's free, and it's fun. A whole lot of fun. Really. Now really, as a special treat, we've even arranged for a random Lollard to get busy on the wheels of shiny plastic. Details of Poptimism and much of the stuff which you're about to hear is available on freakytrigger.co.uk. And if there's anything you'd especially like us to know over the course of the next hour, you can send us a text message on 07733205562. That's 07733205562. How modern. If you're listening to a downloaded version sometime in the future, of course, don't ring that number. We won't even bother answering it. Send us an email or something, you know, if you want. Yeah, whatever. This week, I made a desperate attempt to justify the reprehensible behaviour of my East Devonian compatriots in seeing what they could scavenge from nappies to empty wine barrels from that ship which ran aground just off the coast of my hometown. The town that we happen to be in today, the South Coast's Regency jewel, sunny Sidmouth. I invoke the spirits of wreckers and privateers. 'Tis the law of the sea, said some Cornish type. There's been another instalment of the highly recommended Poptimism podcasts. It's lesson 26 already. Blimey. Anyone paying attention should be really well briefed on pop by now. And if you're not sure you're quite up to FT-style speed, hearing country rap by the Bellamy Brothers may be that one piece you were missing. And only a small matter of 8 months after the experiment took place. Mark here wrote up one of the more challenging of the experiments undertaken on last summer's FT Food Science Day, held at my house, funnily enough. To wit, what cheese is good to fry? Part two. Would you like to talk us through that experiment, please, Mark?
Well, the experiment was to discover what cheese is good to fry. Part two. I can't remember how I came up with that idea in the first place. I was wondering what cheese was good to fry. It's a very simple experiment. You cut cheese in small slices and fry it until it turns into a kind of chewy crisp. And in the original version, I ate them all myself and pronounced them all delicious. But in this one, I thought I'd be a bit more objective and force them on some of my friends who essentially pronounced them all disgusting. But we were using different cheeses, so maybe that's what it comes down to.
I have to say, I was one of the victims of this experiment.
You were doubly a victim because not only did you have to eat some, but your hair smelled of it for the 8 months since.
That's very true. The one in talking to non-Freaky Trigger friends that seemed to surprise the most was the Baby Bell Plus.
Yes, the surprise seems unwarranted. Baby Bell Plus is Baby Bell Classic is a sliced Baby Bell fried into a crisp. Baby Bell Plus is an unpeeled Baby Bell fried into a small crisp.
It came out kind of pink.
It came, well, naturally, because the peel is pink.
And it kind of tasted like earwax, as I recall.
Now, you don't know what earwax tastes like, Tim.
We all know what earwax
tastes like.
It tastes
like real wax.
But surely
wax classic.
The peeled Baby Bell kind of tastes like earwax as well.
Well, I thought people were giving it, were very harsh about it, but then I think wax is delicious. Earwax less so.
How do you know? Anyway, we've also been thinking about the seven wonders of the world, and some bunch of bludgers attempt to elect a new seven out of a field including the Eiffel Tower, those big stone heads on Easter Island, Stonehenge, St. Boris's Cathedral in Moscow, and actually the only 20th century contender.
St. Basil's, actually.
Well, Basil, Boris. Also. Boris is actually Russian for Basil.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. oh, dear. So early in the game. Nevertheless. Also, the Sydney Opera House. How do you feel about this project, Kat?
Well, I think it's better than their original idea, which was to vote off the monument that everyone liked least and then destroy it.
That sounds like an excellent plan to me.
Well, there was a version of that on BBC some time ago where you had to vote for the building you would save.
Restoration.
Restoration.
With Griff Rhys Jones out of the Super Furry Animals.
Yeah, and... I can't remember even which one they saved in the end.
I always thought it would add a little bit of spice to that programme if they actually did say, the ones you don't vote for, we're going to grind to dust.
I think they did, but the thing is, because they couldn't allocate funding for all of them, they could only save one, so the rest were just left to rot.
Yeah, but I remember that the coverage tended to mean that the support society for these various crumbling piles with the... would use the oxygen of publicity to generate special appeals for themselves and save their buildings anyway.
Well, that is what this scheme is aiming to do for such little known monuments as the pyramids of Giza. No one's ever heard of them, and so
Statue of Liberty, obscure.
Exactly.
Liberty, Mola.
No one's ever heard of the Sydney Opera House, so these chaps want to bring them onto the public eye so people will give their hard-earned dollar.
So you think it's good?
I do think it's good. It's people should, I like lists and people voting for things, and what better to apply that to than famous world monuments.
And Alex, are there any buildings you think they've missed they could have included on the list?
I would have really liked to have seen the Sagrada Familia in there, because I think it's a brilliant building.
I think that was on the shortlist.
Was it?
They had to narrow it down from 149 to 21. And then we only vote for the top seven to be in the new seven.
Well, surely on the list of 149, the way it was narrowed down is that the first 21 listed are the ones that end up on it. Nobody reads a list 149 long.
I did on the internet the other day.
You say you did. You claim you did.
Yeah, well, I was wanting to check if the village pump in Ickenham, in my hometown, was listed.
It was
listed.
150.
Is that an actual pump?
It is an actual pump. It was restored about 10 years ago. It's it's dating back to the Doomsday Book.
Blimey.
It wasn't on the list, though.
It wasn't on
Presumably
the list.
Presumably it doesn't work.
It did work up until it was in use.
Up until they restored it.
Up until the late 70s, I think. Okay. People are still actually getting water out of it.
Any others we think they've missed?
Well, in the pictures on the web, a lot of them were of people, big people, like Jesus and the Statue of Liberty and the East Arm. And I felt the one that was missed is the Wicker Man.
Okay.
Because that was awesome.
It's kind of gone, though, the Wicker Man, isn't it? Don't these have to actually still exist?
It was voted off by the inhabitants of Summer Isle.
That brings me to my objection to this. I think that the Seven Wonders Classic should remain Seven Wonders Classic, and that they should have a new Seven Wonders, but this sort of mix and match of Sydney Opera House plus Stonehenge seems a bit... Not that Stonehenge was one of the original ones, so I haven't thought this through properly, have I?
I think Pyramids is the only original one out of the shortlist.
When the Seven Wonders were drawn up, it was the only one that was actually still available to go and look at.
Mm.
For my money, there simply aren't enough big blocks of concrete in there. That's my feeling. More brutalism.
The Kremlin is one.
It's more stone than concrete, to be fair.
You're after something like the Trellick Tower, aren't you?
I really am. Yeah, the Trellick Tower.
Yeah, that should be there. The Barbican.
But better, the Trellick sister tower, the Balfron Tower, which is out in East London.
Oh, God, that's awful,
which
isn't it?
Oh, it's beautiful. I love it. But that's obviously the indie choice, because everyone knows about the Trellick Tower these days. Right, it's time for some music, I think. This, I believe, is DJ Wonder, as selected for us by Mark. What are we about to hear, Mark?
It's called Who.
Is it really?
No, it's called What.
Okay. Baudelaire once said that the real hero is he who keeps himself amused. Now,
for us,
it's not usually associated with the word hero, except in the Cadbury sense, but it's time to see how the first of them has been self-amusing this week. The bottle's been spun and it's pointed towards Freaky Trigger's foremost grammarian, who's been thinking about a grammar of magic in fiction, I think. I suppose in real life too. Mark?
Yes, what I was interested in was the ethics, or the problematic, as the Pine Fox would say, of getting what you want. And obviously in fiction, if you have some setup whereby someone can totally get what they want totally easily, it kind of spoils the idea of fiction altogether, because there's no
struggle.
Story. There's no struggle. What folk stories are full of is a little kind of codified version of the problem of getting what you want. And the neatest setup for this is the little three-point structure, where a woodcutter and his wife are granted wishes by who I can't remember, and it doesn't really matter. They're granted the wishes. The first wish, by the woodcutter himself, a man after all our hearts, I think, is he would like a big sausage. The woodcutter's wife is immediately somewhat nettled by this, what she feels weak idea, lacking in foresight, and in her irritation wishes that the sausage was stuck to his nose. And sadly they have to use up the third wish, unsticking the sausage. And I think that's very nice, memorable, and funny version of the problem, which is that you have to be very careful how you wish for things. And I think underneath, the ethical point that's quite often being made is that actually you can't really structure your desire in this way, that it doesn't have consequences which you don't expect. There's a really nice, creepy horror story by W.W. Jacobs, who was a London writer around the turn of the century, called The Monkey's Paw. And in this story, a family of two elderly parents and a middle-aged son are entertaining a guest who's just come back from the Far East, and he gives them... He's somewhat different to how they remember when he left many years ago. He seems kind of careworn and nervous, and he hands over this little talisman that he's picked up, which is a mummified monkey's paw, and says that it's three sets of people will be granted three wishes each on it, and the first man who had these wishes, his third wish was for death, and the second man was this guy himself, and he never says what his wishes are, but he is very keen that they don't use it. And he goes away, and they're sort of laughing away at this whole absurd story, and they start to think what they would like, and they think, well, we're fairly comfortable, we don't particularly want for very much, but it would be quite handy if our mortgage was paid off, and that's a further £200, which is not a huge, it's quite a modest sum, obviously less modest in 1900 than it is now, but even so, they're not asking for the entire wealth of the Indies. They're asking for something that they probably more or less have earned and deserved, and they're just sort of getting it a little bit early than they would get it otherwise. So they wish for £200. It doesn't appear in a little bag on the table immediately in front of them. So they chuckle that, you know, they've been had by their friend, and go to bed. Next day the son goes off to work. Halfway through the day, someone comes back from the factory to say, well, actually, your son was caught in the machinery, and while the company doesn't admit liability at all, we're offering you as a recompense for your loss £200. Mother shrieks, father faints, a little bit of story to get the son buried, etc., etc. And then a week, 2 weeks later, the mother suddenly thinks, well, we did get our wish, however, you know, so maybe this thing does work. So what if we wish for our son to be alive again? And the two of them have a big argument about, is this a good idea? Surely, you know, can it be right? The upshot is that they make the wish. Nothing happens for a little while. Then there's a really quiet knock on the door. And louder, more insistent. The mother goes downstairs very trepidatiously, tries to get the front door open, it won't open. Meanwhile, the father is suddenly realising what this might entail. Their son was caught in the machinery. It's 2 weeks later.
Ooh, nasty.
The suspense is killing.
The mother can't get the bolt open. It's too high, she can't reach it. She goes to get a chair so she can stand on it. And all the while, the father is hunting around in the dark in the bedroom, trying to work out where he put the monkey's paw. As the door opens, he finds it, desperately wishes, and the door swings open, and the street is completely empty, and there's no one there. End of story. And I think it's quite a nice dramatisation of the issue.
Eek.
Exactly.
That's not the Waltons. Entirely inappropriate for a Sunday lunchtime. What's so special about these blocks of three that seem to be recurring in your wish grammar?
Well, I think really three relates to the idea that the story is nice and memorable and tellable. I think that's the precise reason for it. And it's interesting that when it's longer, Bedazzled, the film Bedazzled with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore has a wish structure which is longer, and it actually has seven wishes. And I think it's interesting that it's a prime number, and I think the reason for that is it doesn't generate sub patterns within it which would confuse the issue. But also, seven is just the sort of nice length that you can't remember, is it six or is it seven or is it eight? And
much like Dirty Harry with his bullets,
six bullets. The films are morphologically as a structuralist, I would argue that those two films are the same.
Okay. That's good to know. So does it ever turn out well? Does this whole wish thing ever turn out well for people in your experience?
One of the versions that seems to turn out well is Aladdin, where he gets to find a lamp with a genie, and basically, after some sort of problems, he gets to be a prince who marries a beautiful woman. End of story. So I think the answer is yes. To be honest, I can't exactly remember the internal details of that, but I think in magic ethics terms, he is confronted by a wizard, and so I think basically he's the least bad of the two people who's dabbling in magic, and the wizard is clearly there's more malfeasance going on there. Mm. So he ends up benefiting because he's not actually generating the bad wishing in the first place.
If the Disney version is anything to go by, I think the addition of a monkey sidekick is somewhat helpful securing a good destiny as a result of these wishes.
It's that monkey's paw again, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Monkeys are clearly involved in a deep way.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough.
So I've got some good news for you lollards this afternoon, and that is that I only have three wishes to grant, so you get one each, but I want to know what your wishes are.
My wish is for more wishes.
You're not allowed that. Oh. Everyone knows you're not allowed. Actually, everyone does know you're not allowed to ask for more, but I've never actually seen that set out in a piece of fiction. It's kind of assumed. It's this assumed thing, isn't it, that you're just not allowed to ask for a million more wishes, please?
Well, in the Disney Aladdin, definitely, because Robin Williams says like no chance.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that.
Right,
it's
in the middle
film.
Of it.
In one of the versions of the three wish stories, there's a fisherman catches a golden fish, and the fish says, okay, if you don't eat me and throw me back, I will grant you, in fact, as many wishes as you like, it turns out. And he goes back home and sort of puzzling about this, and his wife successively wishes to be to live in a nice house, to be rich, to be queen, to be pope, which is kind of an awesome wish, and finally she wishes to be, and it's more than three, and in fact it may be more than the five I've given, it maybe six or seven, she wishes to be God, to be to be able to control all the seas, all nature, all things. And the fisherman, who's each time been sent back to the fish to up the wish, goes back and says, well, my wife is wishing this. And the fish looks at him and says, fisherman, I grant your wish. When you return, you will be living in the same little hut you always lived in, and your wife will have forgotten everything. So maybe that is the problem, that if you're granted all wishes, in other words, you become God. It kind of breaks the whole system of who can do what.
Mm.
And it goes back to the beginning. It's a reboot wish.
All right, I'll have that then.
Alex?
Like a big hippie, I would wish to be happy.
Oh.
Because if I was happy, it would involve everyone else being happy as well.
All the mice on the mouse organ.
Yeah, all of them.
You've got no chance.
I know.
Mark?
I wish that more people would admit to themselves that fried cheese is more delicious than they said it was.
More people than how many?
Than the three who denied it.
I think I liked one of them, didn't I?
No.
Oh, well, so it goes.
Acrid and greasy. That was.
Oh. That's a small blast of unexpected music from the fairground, which is set up in the nice little green at the Ham here in Sidmouth. Now it's time to move to a public service announcement.
And now the theory forecast, issued by the Thought Office, on behalf of the Being Time and Geistguard Agency. The general synopsis at 0600. Conditions critical. Deepening Parisian low expected Columbia by 0600 tomorrow. New right expected Princeton by same time. Berkeley, chill. Norm blog, moderate to wrong, sly at times, decreasing. Orwell, fair, no change. Eagleton, Catholic to High Catholic, slippery, fraud. Zizek, glib, rising to severely glib. Sheik, stales later. Irigaray, Sisu, Dworkin, severe girls, vigorous suppression follows. Greer, listing slowly across channel, gale force whines at times, you decide. Grayling, thin to smug with blustery squalls, passing away towards dawn. Good. Heidogger, Nietzsche, German blight, steady, very poor. There are warnings of severe gall in the following areas. Dawkins, Scruton, Honderich, Singer, Bloom, Habermas, Baudrillard, Hitchens, Negri. The general situation at midnight. Deep moralizing moving north. Lol by midnight Monday. Low Rorty, 2x4.
We'll be right back.
was Talk Talk by Talk Talk, and that's quite enough of that. What we cannot speak about, we must pass over in silence. Dude, I just dropped Wittgenstein on the radio, man. Anyway, that's only really relevant if we, whoever we are in this case, have exhausted all the various possibilities of language before we can work out that we cannot speak about whatever it is we wanted to speak about.
It doesn't seem a very Lollardy motto.
What's that? No, well, quite. What we cannot speak about, we just speak rubbish about. It seems much more apposite at this point. Anyway, Alex has been thinking about ways of constructing languages to do stuff, I believe.
I have indeed. When I first thought of doing this, I thought it would be quite simple, but it turns out there's a lot of constructed languages. But there seem to be various reasons why people decide they want to construct languages. Constructed languages are basically languages which have not evolved naturally. Someone has decided they want a language for a specific purpose and has then gone and constructed it, which is quite an ambitious task. Historically, it seems to have been in medieval times that people would do it because they wanted to kind of get back to a pre-Babel kind of golden age where we all spoke using one universal language. This wasn't very successful, and no one has really discovered a universal language, funnily enough. St. Hildegard in the 12th century decided that she would make her own language by putting her own made-up words onto a Latin grammar. No one else used this, it was just her, but it's possibly one of the earliest examples of this happening. St. Hildegard also prophesied the colour of a cow that was pregnant, and she prophesied the colour of the calf.
I was going to say.
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't just go up to the cow and go, "This is a brown cow." She said, "This cow is going to have another brown cow." And she was right, and she became Blessed Hildegard, but was upgraded to a saint.
Is that Hildegard of Bingen?
Possibly, yes. Bingen Hildegard.
Isn't it quite a regular occurrence for a brown cow to give birth to another brown cow? I mean, I'm no great expert on cow genetics, but it seems...
Possibly in 12th century Germany they hadn't worked that out.
And you got made a saint for knowing that.
She did, yes. But not till the 16th century they thought about it for quite a while.
She was a borderline case, obviously.
Yeah, well, it was just one cow. Anyway, she's one of the first examples, really, of this sort of thing happening, but hers wasn't a proper language anyway. It was just, she was just a bit strange, I think. Anyway, then you get the medieval ones where they want the perfect language, and one of the reasons they wanted a perfect language was because if there was a perfect language, people would be able to convince infidels that the true faith was Christian, and somehow use a perfect tongue to do this. I'm not really sure how they were going to do this, but that was what they decided. Didn't work out either, so they dropped that one. Later on, 17th century, Enlightenment, everyone wants everything nice and classified and in a hierarchy. So a lot of the constructed languages then were the idea of making language very logical and rational and showing the relationships between things. Didn't really work either, because it's not really possible to divide language up into conceptual blocks that easily. But it did lead to things like Linnaean classification of the natural world.
Which is great.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of language. It's just in a very specific area of thought. So that was quite useful. People decided that they would see the world through language in that way, and it would be much more logical. But it didn't really work for small talk and things like that, so, you know, they dropped that as well.
More Linnaean small talk, please.
Yes.
Boobo, boobo, boobo.
I bet you say that to all the girls.
Is that the eagle owl?
An owl. And rat is ratus ratus, which is very logical.
A particular kind of rat is ratus ratus. As you well know, because your Strangler's LP collection contains Rattus Norvegicus, does it not?
That's the black
Every
rat.
Format.
that one's the black rat, and the Rattus Rattus is the brown rat, I believe.
Quite so.
Or is it the other way around?
So, Alex, are they still... Are these language constructors... Sorry, it's time to leave the Stranglers behind. Are these language constructors still busily constructing?
Indeed they are. 19th century saw a lot of the ones that we still have to say... being born, like Esperanto. And there's another one called Ido or Edo, which is actually 20th century, but early 20th century. And Interlingua, which was mid-20th century, actually. And
which means inside a tongue. No, between tongues.
Possibly. Mm. and also, I don't know how to pronounce this one. Volapuk or Wallapuk.
The perfect language. It seems like a bit of a stumbling block to me to invent the perfect language that people actually don't know how to pronounce.
Yes.
But if everyone doesn't know how to pronounce it, then that's a universal...
Perfection of a kind.
Of a kind, yeah.
I suppose so. I have to say, I'm absolutely gagging for you to talk a bit of constructed language to us, Lizzie. Have you got some to treat us with?
I don't really. I can talk to you about Sol Re Sol, which...
It's funny to be like that.
Sol Re Sol is one of the most... one of the craziest of the constructed languages. It was a Frenchman called Jean-François Sudre in 1827 launched this language, which there's two different sorts broadly of constructed languages. Ones which are based on natural languages which already exist but are improvements for whatever reason, and ones which are just created completely from scratch. And Sol Re Sol is created completely from scratch, and it's based on the musical scale, the Do Re Mi Fa Sol La Ti Do.
Okay.
He designed it to be very simple. It's got seven syllables, and each one is one of the bits of the musical scale. So Do is one, Re is one, Mi is one, etc., etc. They don't use T, they use C, S-I, instead of T.
Well, that would be because it would be very confusing. Because T is already a word.
Yes, but so Do.
So
there's a lot of
also C
and
in, you know,
and Ray.
I mean, you're right by the C.
Yeah, but T is a word that everyone wants. People don't want dough until it's...
Well, if they want a bit
of fiber.
If they want some bread with their tea,
or
it's
a deer,
yeah. But bread is different.
A female deer.
Dough a deer.
You have to make bread out of dough.
You do. You don't. Anyway, it's got the seven syllables and. They're based on the musical scales, so you can sing Sol Re Sol using musical notes.
Please, go on.
I can't sing, and I'm not going to. The world doesn't deserve that. But you can also speak it using Do Re Mi Fa So by combining those elements to create words.
Sorry, what's this? What did he bother doing this for?
Oh, because actually, good point. He wanted to create a language which was completely universal. You could sing it, and you could see it. And he also mapped each of the Do, Re, Mi elements to colours and numbers and symbols. And you could also do it by sort of manual signing, like sign language. So it was going to be this great new thing that all deaf and blind and mute people could use to communicate. Didn't take off either, strangely enough. But a lot of that was to do because sign language in 19th century France was suppressed as a method of teaching deaf people because they decided that it would be better to force them to talk, even though they couldn't hear themselves. But that's a whole different thing about sign language.
So is this whole enterprise, whole enterprise just a huge fool's errand? Is it always bound to failure? Is it sometimes quite useful?
Personally, I think it's a huge fool's errand.
Sweet. In that case, I'm all for it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we need to make artificial languages. I think it's great fun, but I think anyone who tries to make it as an international method of communication it's just going to fail. We have languages that evolve naturally, and they're perfectly adequate, I think.
I think you could... I'm looking over Alex's shoulder at her list of words,
yes,
and I noticed that one of the words, meaning industry and commerce... would be spoken la-la. I don't know what pitch you'd have to
this
say.
This was the interesting thing. Each of the syllables that he suggested equated to the musical scale was... Each one would have a concept behind it and a way of classifying the world. So do was to do with anything to do with man or faculties or good qualities or food, whereas mi was to do with human actions and bad qualities. And so you would know what a word was to do with because of the first syllable. which is a terrible system. Because
I think it could be adapted, because I like the idea that Lala is one of the words, but I think instead of dough it should be po, and one of the other words should be tinky winky. And then and only then sol re sol would become universal.
Talking of tinky winky, I'm delighted to say it's time for our first consultation of the day. Dr. Pub has deigned once again to give us the benefit of his always sound advice. Let's hear what he's got.
Yeah, hello. I'm Dr. Pub, and I'm here to answer all your queries on pub and pub going. I'm a man who, when someone says, a man walked into a bar, says, hurrah! This week's query comes from Rita, who has a simple and yet very important query for all pub goers. And indeed, dear Dr. Pub, I like to drink, but I often get peckish, but unfortunately I have a peanut allergy. Can you suggest what else I could eat to make sure my beer doesn't go straight to my head? Well, Rita, I've got the right answer for you, but why not have a laugh and ask the lollards of pop first?
Right then, quick go around the table. What do we like? What do we recommend for the peanut allergic to eat down the pub? Kat?
I was in the pub on Friday, and instead of serving crisps, they had Pringles around the bar.
Pringles are crisps.
They are kind of crisp, but you don't get very many Pringles in one of these small tubes.
They tessellate, though.
They do.
Surely you get more.
Tessellation is not what I want in a bar snack. It's not my priority.
It didn't feel.
I love a bit of tessellation, mate.
Yeah, so I was quite disappointed in that, and I would rather have a pack of Wotsits.
You think Wotsits?
Yeah.
Not enough Wotsits down the pub, actually. It's a good point. Or spicy knickknacks, either.
Something that's got a powdery coating that comes off on your fingers.
Mm. I think coating is underselling what Wotsits are covered in. It's a kind of pan-galactic dirt.
Anyway, what do you recommend for our nut-hating friend, Mark?
Babybel Plus fried. There's no, you can't gainsay it. That's why you've fallen silent. You know that that's the best idea.
My mouth is opening and closing, and there's no noise coming out. If you want to completely ruin the taste of your boozes, then by all means, fry yourself up some cheese and snack away at it to your heart's content. And Alex, any particular pub snack favourites?
Raisins, maybe? Chocolate-coated raisins could be possibly the most disgusting thing.
Poppets,
yeah. The mint ones.
Mint
or
poppets.
Revels.
Mm, would they go with beer?
Maybe. They might float on top of it.
Interesting.
I think we'd better hear what Dr. Pub's got to say on the matter.
Thank you for those entertaining and yet idiotic answers. Rita's problem here is the peanuts, and so we steer away from nuts and towards the potato, some say, the pomme de terre. But I say take the terre away and just go straight for the pomme. Many potato crisps are made in a atmosphere where peanuts would be nearby and therefore not safe for you. So I suggest the apple crisp. It's a refreshing juice-based crisp, which is nice on the tongue and crunchy too. What's more, soaked in brandy and set fire makes an exciting end to any evening. Burning anything in brandy makes a great end to any evening, even your own self. Anyway, happy munching, Rita.
I Want More by Can. I have a feeling Dr. Pub may want more cans also. It did sound as though he'd been self-medicating, rather. There we are. Anyway, I think he'd approve of our next subject, Ms. Judith Chalmers, if only because she manages to maintain the colour of a pint of Magnus cider left to stand in the sun for a day or two. The cheap joke about Judith Chalmers is something to do with her being all leathery, so, you know, you might say that she didn't enjoy a recent trip to Africa because she found herself being hunted for her hide by rhinos who fancied getting themselves a really hard-wearing coat. That kind of thing. But we at Freaky Trigger are above all that, right? Of course we are. Anyway, apparently Kat's been spending a fraction of her precious hours remaining on Earth thinking about Judith Chalmers and her television programmes. Kat?
I have. This week, I finally got round to buying my 2007 diary. Now, it's right at the end of January, and some people might think that's a little bit tardy of me. But
I would say it was just cheap, actually, I have to say.
Well, that as well. But it's making a transition from one year into the next is always a, you know, arduous process, I find. And getting used to writing 2007 on your checks instead of 2006 or whatever year it might be, it always takes some getting used to. And one of the things that used to help me, you know, actually know what year it was, was the holiday programme on BBC, because it used to have the year popped onto the end of the title. So you'd have like Holiday 88, Holiday 89, Holiday 90.
I don't understand the pattern. Can you explain it some more?
I thought Holiday 90 was going to sync without trace because the title didn't scan quite as well as Holiday 89. There weren't enough syllables in Holiday 90. I thought there was just going to be, you know,
it's
up
like
in
mass
up.
Staying at home.
Yeah. And the same with film with Barry Norman. I can't call it film now. Without the year, it sounds wrong, doesn't it? Is it like film 93 or film 99?
Absolutely. It sounds terrible. It's a television programme just called film. Everyone would get so confused. In the listings, it would just say film, and they'd be like, well, what's the film?
I know. But ridiculous. They did drop the year suffix from the holiday programme in the mid-90s. And I think, obviously people, you know, they were getting worried about the year 2000 bug, perhaps. Wish You Were Here never needed a year suffix on the end. And it's because it was the same every year. I think it started in 1969, Wish You Were Here, and like ran for like 34 years or something like
Did
that.
It really?
And they started off, in the very first programme, it was at Torremolinos.
Oh,
which is lovely.
That's very much a problem of getting what you wished for, isn't it? If the first one was Torremolinos, then by the time it had finished, everyone was there.
Indeed. And I was like, well, where can you go from that? I mean, like, there's nowhere up from Torremolinos, surely. There's aspirational television on the BBC on the holiday programme. It's always much higher class.
Is it?
Of holiday. Yeah, I'm sure viewers at home will, you know, sort of be familiar with Jill Dando sunning herself on the side of a Caribbean beach pool, perhaps. And whereas Judith Chalmers just like riding along a donkey on
up Blackpool.
Up Blackpool Way. I was like, oh, some lovely lights up there. I'm enjoying those.
So which one's better? Taking Sides, Cat Stevens.
Taking Sides. Wish You Were Here is, well, it's got that inexplicable Pink Floyd link there, whereas Holiday is Madonna.
It seems pretty clear to me.
It really does. Holiday's clearly the better song, so I would have to go for that.
But you've gone for the low-class option then, Cat.
I have gone for the low-class option.
I expected no less from you, bless your heart.
But in fact, Judith Chalmers is so low class now that, going back to constructed languages, one very well-known constructed language is Cockney rhyming slang. And a Google search this week has found that Judith Chalmers is in fact Cockney rhyming slang for piles.
Oh, it's me Judith, or oh, it's me Chalmers.
Me Chalmers.
Oh, it's me Judith Chalmers.
Me Chalmers are giving me jip.
Yeah. I'm very sorry to hear that.
I know. I don't know if this can be applied to any television presenter from Stockport, such as Yvette Fielding, Tess Daly, Paul Morley, or even DJ Daz last year's...
DJ Daz.
DJ Daz last year's Eurovision entrant, and this year's as well, I believe. He's teaming up with Carol Decker from Topal.
And Morrissey, excellent. So, team, Alex, have you ever actually gone anywhere as a result of seeing it advertised on some televisual, the Breakaway programme?
No.
Nowhere?
No, because I don't tend to watch them, because I usually think, I can't afford these holidays, therefore what's the point in torturing myself by seeing people who can?
Self-torture's underrated.
Yes.
Well, I like those David Attenborough ones, where he goes to, you know, underneath the polar sea, or
sits with gorillas in there.
Something achievable.
Something where he sits with algae in the volcanic subterranean of the tundra somewhere.
And there's nice spas in Iceland, so I've heard.
You know, nice owls.
What? Spas.
Spas.
There are nice lagoons where you can go and sit in the volcanic warm water. It's fun.
Quaffing incredibly alcoholic drinks.
I don't know what you mean.
You're not meant to drink and swim, though, are you? It's dangerous.
That's eating and swimming.
I'm sure drinking and swimming
eating
is
and
also
drinking.
A bit hazardous.
Eating and drinking is the
yeah. Never eat, never drink and eat. It's well known. So you have been encouraged to go on holiday and sit with some algae as a result of seeing David Attenborough on the telly. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Well, what I realised after some thought and look at my bank balance was that it was better to sit with algae at home as I watched television, and that was very easily arranged.
Right, how delightful. I remember Monks being incredibly annoyed by one of those holiday shows, and I think it was probably the BBC one, which was Holiday, because they went to Jamaica, and I thought, oh, I'm interested in Jamaica, having been a big fan of Jamaican music for some time, and I thought, oh, they'll be interested to see what they say about Jamaica, and they ended up going up some river in the forested inland bit of Jamaica and kind of avoiding the urban bit altogether. And I thought, well, this is an opportunity at least for them to play some Jamaican music, and they played Old Man River. not even a Jamaican version of Old Man River, of which I'm sure there are many, but just they play, and I just thought, what an appalling lack of imagination on their part. And it always, that sometimes you get really nicely chosen music on those programmes, and it brings the whole thing alive, and it makes it worth watching, even if you know you're never going to go to, you know, Venezuela. But much of the time, I find myself really annoyed by their refusal to.
But surely the problem is, it's not so much Jamaica, which they would probably be quite happy with, but it's setting a precedent that when they have a programme about France, they would have to play French music.
French music's awesome.
Well. Find a Switzerland.
Well, no, Swiss
the young
health.
Gods.
Hello, Yellow and the Young Gods. Dear BBC, please employ us now. Anyway, I think it's probably time for you bunch of sickos to get one more doctoral consultation. This is one doctor who certainly won't self-medicate. It's our old friend, Dr. Drugs.
Good afternoon, Resonance listeners. Dr. Drugs here. Friend of parents and educators worldwide in their struggles for a drug-free pop culture. Speaking of which, here's a note I received from a teacher, Miss X.
Dear Dr. Drugs, I listen to your segment every week, and I have been inspired to take up arms myself in the lonely war on songs about drugs. Just last week, I confiscated a copy of Everything Starts With an E by Easy Pussy featuring MC Kinky from a student of mine. He protested his innocence, but I was having none of it. I might be a stereotypical bookish spinster, but I know a reference to the devil drug ecstasy when I hear it. I think you would have been proud of my actions.
Well, Miss X, I would think again. You see, everything does indeed start with an E. And so does education. And your ill-informed actions have denied some unfortunate his first faltering steps on the pathway to literacy. Ask yourself this. Are you sure? Are you really sure that the massed chorus of ecstasy, ecstasy is Easy Posse flaunting their slavish allegiance to MDMA? Or merely uttering their delight at their grasp of the basic alphabetic principle? Similarly, are the verses of MC Kinky the prattlings of a gurning she-fool riding a drug high, or are they a complex phonetic learning system? You, my dear, are a disgrace to your profession. Never darken my mailbag again. Thank you.
Everything starts with an E.
Ah, well,
Yes, but now I see that I have not understood the crux of the matter, said Lukács to his followers one day. And what is that? They asked the master. He replied, the trouble is, I don't know. I kind of know how he felt. You've been listening to Alex Campbell, Cat Stevens and Mark Sinker. Cast Miles Steve Hewitt has been our producer this week. You can find us on the internet at freakytrigger.co.uk. And yes, that does include details of the dancing arm of FT's ever-expanding media empire, Club Talk Poptimism, which is next Friday. In case you didn't hear me earlier. We've been broadcasting live from the fish shop by Branscombe Beach. No, not Branscombe, Sidmouth. God. And it's just as well we're leaving because the dead fish are starting to complain about the smell. It remains to me to announce the good news of this week's new number one. The internets have been going a bit mental because... you may remember a few years ago there was a hit record where Ski Lo did a rap called I Wish over a heavy sample of Survivor record, Eye of the Tiger. And some internet wag has put that rap to a groovy mid-90s hip-hop beat and it's all over the internet like wildfire. So the new UK number one is I Wish by Ski Lo, and here it is.
Hello? I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl who looked good, I would call her. Wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat and a 6-4 fall. I wish I was like 6'9" so I can get with Leo. She, cause she don't know me, but yo, she's really fine. You know, I see her all the time, everywhere I go, and even in my dreams, I can scheme a way to make her mine. Cause I know she's living fat, her boyfriend's tall, and he plays.
Stay tuned for The Other Woman, all female playlist selected by Ruth Barnes, followed by Calling All Pensioners and the Rocket 88 Doo Wop Rock and Roll Show, which begins at 3 here on Resonance 104.4. Today's show was brought to you by the word Wish. I'm Tim Hopkins, and thanks for listening, and sorry.